Peter, good to see you again. How's everything going?
Oh, it's great to see you, Jimmy. Things are good coming up on Thanksgiving here, so counting our blessings.
And that's an interesting way to view it because, according to you, there's going to be some pain in the works, and that's what we're going to talk about. But before we get to all of that,
Yes.
I think we should sort of like start off with some of the basics. We have this word stagflation, which has been sort of part of the cultural lexicon. But you're an Austrian economist. Can you define for us what stagflation is and whether it's a legitimate economic concept or not?
So stagflation is when you've got high inflation with slow growth, and it's definitely legitimate. In the 1970s, that was really the last time that we had a bad run of stagflation in the US. And at the time, they had something called the misery index, which is the sum of the inflation rate and the unemployment rate. And, you know, those are really probably the two most salient economic facts for anybody, at least in the short term, right? In the long term, what you care more about is income growth, right? So how much your salary, what's the buying power of your salary? But in the short run, so in terms of elections, for example, definitely what people care about is inflation and jobless rates. And when you have stagflation, that's when both of those are doing badly.
And we did have a lot of turnover that decade, particularly in the Oval Office. I think we had what, let's see, between Nixon and
And JFK both had handoffs for very different reasons, right? Yep.
But like that, you had that handoff, and then Ford didn't get reelected, and then Carter didn't get reelected. It seemed
Right.
pretty precarious for any politician having that there as sort of like the economic issue.
Yeah, it was an interesting era, and I think we can learn a lot from that whole period going through the 1960s through the 1970s. And I think for an Austrian economist, one of the most, you know, one of the most tragic elements of that whole episode was Nixon finishing off the gold standard. Now, to be fair, he did it temporarily. All right. So in 1971, with the Nixon shock, he said, "I'm instructing the whatever Secretary of Treasury to temporarily suspend redemption of gold." So presumably at some point that will wear off and we'll go back to normal.
Of
And
course.
of course I'm joking. Once they get a hold of some power, they are never ever giving it back. But the other aspect of the 60s and 70s that's interesting to me is that it really eroded public trust in the government. So if you go back to like 1962, most Americans thought that the government was kind of this like daddy, okay? Like government would come in, this wise overlord who would look over you. And you still see this kind of naivete on the left, you know, where once the government declares something to be true, they then give that an extra boost. But a lot of Americans now, I mean, even if the government says something true, they don't believe them anymore, which I think is extraordinarily healthy. But the 60s and 70s were really the last time, or that was, I'd say, the first time in modern era, in other words, since FDR's censorship regime, that was really the first time that people started doubting the government in large numbers. Now, if we look at COVID, I think that has arguably been a bigger impact on people trusting not just the government, but the institutions more broadly. So, trusting universities, trusting quote unquote the science. Even trusting the military or some of the more liberal churches that have seemed to either be captured by literal left-wing activists or to have sort of gone along to get along and played along with this totalitarian experiment that we've been running since COVID.
Well, we can get into this in a little bit, but when I interviewed Rahim Takaminazan, he expressed the idea that trust is actually kind of a capital good, and the
It
reduction
is,
of
yep.
trust is sort of like one of the ways in which we're kind of eating our seed corn. Like if
Yes.
you're taking advantage of people's trust, you're crumbling civilization in many ways.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely accurate. And, you know, of course, it's coming from the organizations themselves. They have rendered themselves untrustworthy. And I think all of us would love to have an FDA we could trust or an SEC we could trust. Like, you know, a lot of these organizations. Now, of course, I think the private sector can do it better. But if we're going to have government organizations interfering in these various areas, then we would far prefer to have people we can actually trust, people who are trying to be honest with us. You know, in the financial realm, I mean, it's just comical. Every time you have a bank go down, you know, you can just cue them. They line up like marionettes all dancing along how our banking system is fundamentally sound. It's to the point where, like, if you see that there's a Sunday night press conference with Janet Yellen and Jerome Powell, you get real nervous. Like, you would call your broker and you would say, oh, my God, what just happened? Right? Why are these people out there telling lies? And so, yeah, I think without a doubt. And, you know, of course, the most important public goods aspect of trust is trust between individuals, right? So can you trust your neighbors? Can you trust people you work with? Can you trust the companies with which you do business, your customers, if you are the business? And there, I think that the left has really worked very hard to set people against each other to attack social trust. They use any reason to attack. It could be income, it could be identity, it could be sexuality. I mean, it's like they just full-time seek out new ways to divide people against each other. And, I mean, this has always been the project in socialism. Socialism is sort of the political version of a civil war. You are trying to set people against each other so that you can enact some sort of revolution. For the true believers, they think that revolution will make the world a better place. And, you know, of course, in the process, you're going to sort of pick up all of these grifters who are going to join the revolution for their own interests. So, you know, maybe Joseph Stalin is kind of the iconic version of that. But either way, you know, I think that social trust has really been under attack. The fact that so many left-wing institutions, particularly the sort of commanding heights of thought, so meaning education and media, the fact that those have been captured by this sort of trust-destroying left, I think is really the source of why a lot of us feel like the country is falling apart and are concerned for what comes next.
Well, so let's talk, before we talk about what comes next, let's talk about what's happened. So you mentioned earlier that the 70s were the last time that we saw significant stagflation. What are the causes of stagflation? And, you know, besides the obvious money printing, like there seems to be certain triggers or something, you know, that makes everyone realize, okay, now we need to, we're really like in a lot of trouble. What actually causes it?
Yeah, so if we take the 1970s as sort of concrete example, the government, the federal government started spending too much in the 1960s. And they were doing this because at the time it was called guns and butter. So they were spending a lot on the Vietnam War. They were, of course, spending a lot on, you know, maintaining U.S. military presence all over the world. But at the same time, they were also spending enormous amounts on Lyndon B. Johnson's so-called Great Society, which was basically the imposition of a socialist social policy on the U.S. to try to imitate the European welfare state. So spending on both of those at the same time, that created inflation. That was what led directly to Nixon breaking the gold backing of the U.S. dollar. So other countries noticed that inflation. They started fearing that the U.S. dollar was going to get weak. So they started asking for their money back. So that gave us kind of the inflation portion of it. The stagflation came as the inflation took off. It ultimately reached in that first burst about 12%. The Fed could have reacted in two different ways. They could have sat down with the federal government and said, you need to control yourself. You need to cut back on the spending. The Fed could have, you know, failed to cooperate in sort of normalizing all that spending, getting the financial markets to digest it. So the Fed could have played hardball with the federal spending. The other thing that they could have done was to sort of clear the highway, right? Clear off all the cars so that the feds can drive as fast as they can. And that's, of course, what they did. And so what that looks like is raising interest rates in order to choke off the private sector. So if you make interest rates really high, then it's hard to borrow money. And so consumers spend less, businesses spend less, which is, you know, that's their main target. And so effectively, rather than reducing the federal spending, you reduce American people's spending. And if you can get that back down, then even with the government spending all that extra money, you can bring inflation down. Now, the problem with doing it that way is that hiking rates that fast often sets off a recession. So that's exactly what happened in the 1970s. There was one period or one moment where the economy was turning a negative 10% growth over one quarter. Now, they later revised that to minus 5, but at the time, the Fed thought that it was minus 10. So they panicked. They yanked rates back down. They said, okay, we got to stop choking the private sector, because the Fed fundamentally, they're not operating on what's good for the country. They're operating on what's good for the Fed. And they know that the inflation rate and the jobless rates, right? Remember, those are the two key numbers. So they know that they are being graded on those two numbers, right? And so they're kind of walking this tightrope, at least in the early 70s, where, you know, they knew they had to get inflation down because people were questioning the Fed's powers. But they didn't want the jobless rate to get too high because they would get blamed for that. So they yanked down rates. We got a couple years of kind of, you know, slower inflation, but then because of those lower rates, there's always a lag. It's typically about 18 months or something. Because of those lower rates, stagflation took off again. That second time that it took off is actually a lot worse than the first, and that only ended because they did this sort of shock therapy of extremely high rates from a guy named Paul Volcker, the Fed chair at the time. So that's the 70s pattern. Spend too much, and then you yank up rates to try to, you know, control the inflation, and that crashes the economy. Now, that pattern is exactly what we repeated with COVID, right? So governments all over the world pumped out these massive deficits in order to essentially bribe voters into accepting the lockdowns. Numbers just came out. We're looking at $9 trillion in deficit spending in the past 3 years. So that is a astronomical amount. That's not far from what the entire U.S. government used to spend a couple of years ago, back towards the 2008 crisis. All right, so that's an enormous flood of money. There was a moment in 2001 where one out of $3 had fresh ink on it, just been printed up using the pandemic as an excuse. So we had a repeat of the early 70s. Instead of guns and butter, we just had a whole ton of COVID stuff that drove inflation up. The Fed then responded by hiking rates at the fastest pace since the 1970s. That slowed the economy. So now we're at the point where they only really got rates to the restrictive level about 3 months ago, okay, August. And normally you don't tend to see rates really impact for about 18 months. So we've still got, going by history anyway, we've got like another year until the full recession hits in force. Already we're seeing a lot of areas where, you know, the statistics are as bad as 2008. You would not expect that this early in the rate hike. So, you know, when I go through the numbers, I get people who push back. They're like, you know, you say the economy is going to collapse. It's not collapsed. So, yes, it typically takes 18 months. And you know, I'm trying to warn people that a storm is coming. Going back to your first point, though, on it, you know, like, not to get too close to Thanksgiving yet, but I do think that it's important for people to realize that, yes, a storm is coming, but storms do not last forever, right? We are still enough of a democracy that the people are going to push back. You know, we saw that in the 1970s, for example. If you were sticking around in 1978 with Jimmy Carter, he was about as useless as the current guy. People thought that, you know, it was just going to keep going forever, that inflation was going to keep going. The jobless rate was over 10%. But what happened, of course, is that people get angry, right? People get angry when inflation is going on for years. They get angry if the economy is doing badly. People get angry and they look for outsiders. And, you know, at the time it was Ronald Reagan. The media treated Reagan exactly the same way that they treated Trump. They called him a racist. They pulled every naughty word out of the dictionary. They compared him to Austrian corporals. They called him a madman, said he would start World War III. I mean, it was the exact same game plan each time. The thing is, back then, the American people did not buy it, and, you know, they opted for change. And then we got the morning in America, which was the Reagan era, high economic growth. We got low inflation. We got that Goldilocks economy.
Well, that's interesting though, because Reagan came much further into stagflation than we are with possibly Trump. How does that change the current equation? Because in a sense, everything seems a little bit more accelerated this time around than back in the 70s.
Yeah, it does. And you know, notably, Trump came in with the economy was doing okay. Right. In 2016, the economy was doing reasonably decent. It was a little bit slow. There were some indicators that we were kind of late stage. But 2016 was certainly not a crisis in the American economy. And yet people voted for Trump. And, you know, I think a lot of us, even those of us who liked Trump, or, I mean, I like Ron Paul more than anybody, but I will take Trump over whatever else Washington serves. I think many of us, you know, even if we preferred Trump over Hillary, we were absolutely shocked. And I think where that's coming from, you know, the fact that people are sort of seeing through socialist policy a lot earlier, I think that that's fundamentally the internet. You know, if we go back to the 1970s, Murray Rothbard, the economist, he's got a line where he says, if you took the entire liberty movement in America in the 1970s, you could fit them in a single living room in New York. And keep in mind, in the 1970s, the liberty movement in America was by far the biggest one on the entire earth. You know, if you're British or French or something, like if you're a libertarian in the 70s, you are immigrating to New York to try to find other like-minded people who believe in freedom. Now, if you look today with the internet, it is, even with the censorship, okay, it is nothing like that. I mean, in the 1970s, if you wanted to learn about, let's say, libertarian ideas, you had to either be lucky enough to run into a libertarian somewhere in person who would explain these things to you, or every so often they would have little mimeographed, okay, like purple ink on them, little basically Xeroxed, stapled together. Right? You remember those things? And, you know, they would stick them in like anarchist bookstores and I guess pray that the anarchists don't connect the dots that, you know, this is that like the immune system wouldn't trigger at the bookstore. And in there, you'd have a little send a self-addressed stamped envelope with $20 to subscribe to get the mimeograph. I mean, it was rough, all right? So even with all the censorship that we've been going through, you know, a couple of years ago, I didn't want to talk to the kids about politics. I figured there'd be plenty of time for that. But I was sitting there one day, and the kids show up. They were like 6 and 8. And they're like, so, Dad, did you know global warming is a hoax? I'm like, that's interesting. Where did you hear that? And they're like, oh, YouTube. And then they show me all these YouTube videos. And even with the censorship, this stuff, it gets through. You know, we have to be cute in how we phrase things. You know, we have to use all these euphemisms. But compared to what it was like in the 1970s, I mean, it's just a whole different world. And that's encouraging to me, right? Because when people get down and they talk about how all the institutions are captured, I'm with you. Absolutely. But if you look at the challenges liberty was facing, right. So in the 50s, when you still had FDR's censorship regime in full force, you know, we didn't have an independent media after FDR crushed it. We didn't have an independent media in this country until Rush Limbaugh in like 1986. And it was Rush against the entire frickin' world. Right. So, you know, if I mean, honestly, looking at what previous generations had to go through, we got it easy.
That's an interesting perspective that it was more socialist before, because typically the argument is that we're getting more socialist now. But I think what you're arguing is, in many ways, at least in the communication and internet realm, it's been way more free now.
Absolutely. In the realm of speech, you know, they planted seeds and those seeds grow. Okay. So, you know, for example, the school system, the public schools, I think, are much more captured today than they were when you and I went through them. So yes, in many ways it's worse because those seeds have grown into trees, but at the same time, free speech is fundamentally, that is our self-defense. I think that is the most important thing to defend, because that is the only way that we're going to get out of this, except for other means that we don't want to get into.
Well, so I want to touch upon something that I think Nixon said. He admitted himself to be a Keynesian in the beginning of this stagflation era and tried a lot of really ridiculous things like price controls and things like that. But you know, we're in a Democratic administration right now, and the Fed is raising rates because they seem to see that lowering them is just going to make the matter worse. Are they just like more Austrian than we think, or like sort of going that way because they recognize reality? Like, do they not believe Keynesianism or modern monetary theory anymore? What's your take on that?
Yeah, they're probably, I wish they were more Austrian, without a doubt. They're basically playing the neoclassical shtick, which is, I mean, it is largely Keynesian. So, you know, the government makes the economy grow. The difference between somebody who would call themselves a Keynesian and somebody who might call themselves a Chicago school, okay, so basically just a sort of non-Keynesian neoclassical, is that the Chicago school, so that's Milton Friedman, that believes that monetary policy is much more powerful, and so when you have inflation, you should use rates instead of using government spending to try to fix it. That, you know, the vast majority, certainly of professional economists, are mainstream, so neoclassical. Mm-hmm. Generally, the ones on the left might call themselves Keynesians, the one on the right might call themselves Chicago school. But, I mean, there's relatively little difference between them. Austrians, of course, are way over here on the side with, you know, complete, you know, we want to, basically we won't want Javier Milei wants, so, you know, slash the government by 60, 75%, ideally 100%, but if you'll
take 60,
NCAP,
70, yeah, yeah.
Yes, yes, right. Yeah, we can start at 75% and then, you know, we can sit down and discuss whether to keep the remainder employed or to send them off to do something productive with their lives. But right, the, you know, majority of mainstream economists are basically Keynesians, so some flavor, either the Chicago school or you know, the Keynesian school itself. Milton Friedman, notably, you know, he and Rothbard sort of mixed it up. Rothbard is probably the most popular member of the Austrian School of Economics, and he and Milton Friedman did mix it up quite a bit. There's a lot of common ground, so, you know, Friedman is probably the most popular economist for, let's say, a mainstream right-wing economist at a university or in the Republican Party, something like that. Friedman believed in a much smaller government, but he also believed in things like he thought the government should control the money. Of course, Austrian economists generally think that government should not control it, that it's a fraud and a scam, and that they destroy the world with economic cycles. So there are pretty major differences between us. But yeah, I think the Fed is probably just, you know, running through their Milton Friedman textbooks. Jerome Powell, and this is maybe a little bit scary, Jerome Powell is pretty much the best we have in Washington, you know, in terms of a Fed chairman. I mean, he's as good as it gets. You know, when Biden was re-upping his term, some of the other candidates that were floated were out and out MMT inflationists. Jerome Powell is pretty much the hardest money guy, you know, who we could hope for. And notably, he was appointed by Donald Trump. He was only reappointed by Joe Biden. So, you know, Powell has given a lot of lip service to Paul Volcker, who's kind of the champion of hard money for raising rates so hard. But so far, he's been pretty milquetoast. He has not been willing to stand up to federal spending. Just recently, about a month ago, he sort of broached his first topic on it, saying that, you know, maybe the feds might want to reduce the pace of of new debt that they put out. And of course, they're hurtling off a cliff at full speed. So, you know, that's all a big light, you know, it's going a bit easy on them. And Powell had been asked, so over the past year, several times at press conferences, he's been asked whether federal spending is part of the reason for inflation. And his response has generally been indignant, you know, like you insulted his wife. You know, he was like, well, you know, we don't tell Congress what to do. And this is, of course, because Congress fundamentally has the power to restrict the Fed's power or the Fed's independence. The Congress, if they wanted, could just turn the Fed into an in-house money printer. The fact that they can do that means that the Fed effectively acts as an in-house money printer. But Jerome Powell doesn't want to lose that formal independence.
Well, so let's talk about that a little bit, because we've had a monetary contraction as a result of these higher rates, but what we're getting instead is an increase in government spending. How does that affect the current economy? Because Essentially, you know, businesses and people aren't spending, and instead government is making up for it. How does that change the equation, and how does that change the economy?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and that's a huge problem. It's a problem in America. It's also a problem in Europe, where they are constricting the private sector, so they're crushing businesses and households, trying to get inflation back down, but then government just floods right in and occupies all that land in the form of new spending. They, you know, put out these stimulus packages. They put out what we had. It was called Build Back Better, and then they renamed it the Inflation Reduction Act with Joe Biden. And, you know, that was just like a trillion, or I think it was $800 billion of crony handouts for green stuff. I mean, it's just endless. And, you know, when you sort of zoom out and see what's happening to the economy, most of the economy traditionally, of course, has been the private sector. And the government chunk is now growing larger and larger. So in the U.S., for example, the government takes about it's actually about half of what everybody earns between the federal, the state, the local. And, you know, with these stimulus packages, it's then taking more and more real resources. So what ends up happening is that the government grows. It grows during crises. And then now that we're in the sort of cleanup after a crisis, it's growing as well. So whether it's raining, whether it's whether it's sunny out, the government grows no matter what. And so the problem with that is it moves you towards that stagnation, right? The stagnation part of stagflation. It moves you towards really a Soviet economy where the economy stops growing. We're seeing this already where, you know, you've got millennials who are angry because they grew up in like a four-bedroom house that their parents owned, okay? And then now they're hitting their 30s. They're living with roommates, eating ramen. They cannot even see a path to get back to the kind of lifestyle that they grew up in. Okay, and that's new in American politics because for, you know, 200 years, every generation was richer than their parents. In fact, they were typically about twice as rich as their parents. So the sort of American experience would be, you know, grandparents looking at their, especially at their grandkids and saying, boy, I can't imagine all the opportunities that you people have today. And what we're getting now, when we see these millennials talking online, we're starting to move towards an Argentina outcome where, you know, years ago in the 90s, I lived in Argentina. I had a cab driver. He had been a professor of literature and his son was not literate. Okay. What? He had to work two jobs while the son was growing up. So the kid had trouble reading. I mean, that this is what we're moving towards. You know, we're moving away from this country where each generation is richer, and we're moving towards that kind of catastrophic Argentinian outcome. Now, why did Argentina do it? The exact same thing. Government spent too much. It took over too much of the economy. It played, I don't know the details of exactly its hyperinflations, but they've had five since 1975. And that's, you know, of course, a big reason why Javier Milei won the other day.
Well, that sort of shock outcome, I think, would be crazy to see. And it took Argentina a long time before, you know, they're willing to give somebody like Milei a chance. How long do you think it takes in the U.S. to get, you know, does it need to get that bad, basically, get something different?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you could call it the boiling frog index that, you know, there's some point where things are so bad that the voters jump. Apparently that just happened in Argentina. But as you say, I mean, what, we're going back to 1975 that they've had these hyperinflations, not like 20% calling that, okay, no, literal hyperinflations. And just now they're getting around to electing somebody who might change it. So that's a concern. I mean, that's a big reason why I do the daily videos, is that I'm trying to let the frog know that the water is getting hot before they actually start dying. But yes, that is the concern. I think a lot of it has to do with how quickly it happens, right? And I mean, that's you know, part of the boiling frog story, Aesop's fable. That's what happened in the 1970s, for example, is that things got so bad so fast that people could see the change with their own eyes. I think that we are going through one of those periods right now. You know, if you look at what prices are 25, 30% higher than they were 3 years ago, that's with official numbers. People can absolutely see it. They're angry about it. We haven't seen the next shoe to drop yet, which is the high jobless numbers. When that hits, I think we're going to have a ton more appetite If that happens before the next election, then I think the vote counters will have a very, very hard time.
Well, so let's talk about unemployment, because one of the things that I'm seeing is that there aren't as many layoffs as you would think, right. At least like, you know, from what I remember with like the dot-com stuff and like 2008. And I mean, there were just layoff after layoff, other than maybe a few tech companies. I think Citi is talking about doing some layoffs, something like that.
Right.
Just doesn't feel like these companies have it in them to go and lay off like 20-30% of their workforce. What's going on?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We've seen a little bit in tech. So there's been a fair number of tech layoffs. But there's also a special reason for that, which is that a lot of tech companies expanded really quickly during the pandemic because everybody was spending all this time online. And so that's more kind of letting go that temporary demand. More broadly, we have not seen that much. We're just starting to see mass layoffs in shipping, for example, you know, which is kind of a canary in the coal mine for the economy in general. But still, it's pretty early days. And I think what's been happening with jobs is really two things. One of them is that a large number of Americans exited the labor force during COVID. So my colleague at Heritage has tallied that up. Roughly 5 million people left the labor force. Some of those people retired early. Some of them went on government benefits. So for a couple of years there, it was more or less no questions asked on government benefits. They were just approving anybody. Because remember, there was a lockdown to buy, right? So they didn't care how much it cost. They wanted you to be sitting on the couch as long as you voted to continue it or you know, in the opinion polls, told them to keep it up. So, right, we're missing about 5 million Americans out of the workforce. That created, you know, of course, these horrible labor shortages back then. You had all these small business people who were working like 7 days a week, 80 hours because they could not get staff. That then led to the second reason, which is labor hoarding. So normally, companies usually labor hoard going into any recession. Hoarding means that you just hold on to them. It's very hard to find workers. You know, there's this kind of socialist fantasy that businesses are sitting around just, you know, throwing darts at the wall on who they want to fire next because they enjoy it. No, the truth of it is it's very hard to find people. It typically takes about 6 months before a worker is actually profitable because you have to train them. You make mistakes. If you hire the wrong person, it might cost you about 6 months' salary. It's very, very hard to find people. And so companies are normally reluctant to hire them or to lay them off or to fire them. They'll generally wait until pretty deep into the recession to do that. So, you know, if you look at the last couple of recessions, the layoffs really happen mid to late recession. The first couple of months, you know, even when you're in the actual recession, the first couple of months, companies tend to hold on to people. So that's in normal times. But if you take what just happened with this massive labor shortage we had here during COVID, I think that's magnified, where a lot of companies almost have post-trauma stress disorder, where they're like they're really being, you know, they're really afraid of being shorthanded again. And so they're probably hoarding longer than they normally would. So that means that any job losses that we do get, they're probably going to be a lot later in the recession than even what normally happens.
So I think your thesis on the stagflation depends on this number going up and then sort of the Fed reacting to maybe unemployment, you know, going up and then saying, okay, now we got to lower rates because, you know, like that's
Bingo.
Only two things that they're thinking about. So if that's the case and, you know, we're still in the early innings of this recession, then, I mean, I think what you're saying is we're going to see another year, maybe possibly, or two of higher rates before they come back down. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the trick is that we have no idea. We just conducted a massive experiment during the COVID lockdowns. We have not done that, certainly in modern times, you know, to literally like shut down half of the economy. that's not normal. And so we don't exactly know. You know, most of finance, like when you turn on CNBC and they're talking about what's going to come next and what's earnings going to do and inflation, all this, they are always going off past recessions. So they are looking at statistical correlations. The problem, of course, is that so if you go back to, say, 1975, we've had what on the order of six recessions. OK, if you go back to 1950, it's been maybe 12 or so. That's not a statistical sample, right? Like, you know, if you take 12 things and run it through I mean, you need like thousands to get a really nice statistical correlation. So generally speaking, what's happening, whether it's analysts at the Fed or analysts on Wall Street, is that they're essentially, they're always necessarily fighting the last war. So they're guessing what's going to happen based on what happened last time. So based on what happened last time, if the restrictive level is when the clock starts, then yes, we're looking at another year before the, you know, full storm hits. If, on the other hand, if the clock starts when they start raising rates, okay, which was about a year previous to that, then, you know, we're coming up real close here. We're coming up a couple months. But the thing is, nobody actually knows. Nobody can know. We don't have the statistical samples for it. And, you know, if you go through even just the logic of it, you know, you track things like, for example, how many companies have cheap loans that were left over from the zero interest rate days? You'd have to really dig in and see how fast are they going through those? How fast are they going to continue to go through them? A lot of those things, they're in theory knowable when the AI reaches its final form. But at the moment, we don't have anywhere near the ability to even see all that's happening inside of that.
Well, so we got kind of you know, two things sort of like coming at each other, and you know, who blinks first kind of game here, because in a sense the companies are waiting to see what happens because they want to hold on to their labor and hoping for lower interest policies so they can, you know, be profitable doing that, and the Fed is actually waiting for the unemployment numbers to get worse before they actually start. So I mean, like, in a sense, they're kind of at loggerheads here, aren't they?
Yeah, and you know, they're both praying for a miracle. So external events, they're just kind of waiting, hoping that something might happen to break that logjam. The Wall Street Journal just put out a piece a couple weeks ago where they went through what brought inflation down to the point it is today. Right, today we're looking at roughly 4%-ish, and you know, of course, what a year. A year and a half ago, we were looking at 9%. So that is a pretty dramatic come down. But they sort of dug into what those numbers are. And almost all of that is either random external factors. So things like supply chains clearing up, energy prices coming down, you know, because both were constrained during the pandemic. And so that's overwhelmingly what's bringing bringing inflation down. The problem, of course, is that both of those are very closely tied to recession coming. And so the question is, how much of that is, you know, temporary factors wearing off, and how much of that is just the recession itself incoming? The Fed, of course, wants it to be the recession. They don't want it to be a real bad recession. They don't want it to be one that gets people angry enough to make Congress do anything to them. But they want a recession because, remember, they want to clear all the traffic so the Feds can drive real fast. So, yeah, we're in a funny place where, you know, the economic numbers that are coming in, the Fed is kind of digging through those and trying to figure out how much of it is just random noise from the outside, how much it is the recession itself. But if we look at the core numbers, that's the core inflation, and that's the inflation number that strips out energy and food. It's the one that the Fed pays the most attention to. They don't really pay attention to the headline numbers that that the news media enjoys. If we dig into that core, the improvement in core since that peak back a year and a half ago, it's been very, very small. I mean, it's been on the order of about a 1% improvement. So sort of on the fundamentals of inflation, we have really not seen very much improvement. And I think at this point, the Fed is just kind of praying for a miracle, hoping that something comes in that will take the heat off them. And then at that point, they would cut rates, right?
Right. What sort of miracle could like they be hoping for? I don't know, Biden dies and like Kamala Harris becomes president? Like what are they looking for? What would relieve them of this burden?
Yeah, they've got a couple of mechanisms. So one of them is that productivity spontaneously improves in the economy. So, you know, companies can make more stuff at lower prices. And so that would, you know, bring down in inflation sort of in real terms. Now, you know, what would be driving that sort of thing? So maybe if from their perspective, from our perspective, we know exactly what would drive that down, which is government stops spending so much money. It returns money to the private sector. It reduces taxes so that companies have more incentive to build stuff. It reduces regulation so companies have more freedom to build stuff. Now, none of those are going to happen. At you know, Washington is going to fight everything it can to do it. The Uniparty is you know, one of the things they agree on is that the government should interfere in the economy more. But you know, that's really that's the main way out of it. The alternative is that the global economy just falls into a hole, and it falls into one so hard that spending comes down. So corporate spending comes down, household spending comes down, and that would also lower the inflation. Then at that point, they get into that tight line, that tightrope that they were walking back in the early 70s, where they have to decide, you know, what's the sort of public opinion impact of inflation versus the jobless number, and then they have to make their own calculations. That's the concern. That's where we get back to that possibility of a sort of double hump in stagflation. And if we do get there, then my biggest concern is that the way we got out of it last time isn't because the economy healed on its own. It's because of what Volcker did. And, you know, the problem is that Volcker in many ways saved the country. I mean, he would have done a lot better to reimpose the gold standard. But at any rate, within his constrained space, he saved the country. The problem is that from Washington's perspective, Volcker was a huge mistake, right? The guy who appointed Volcker lost his job, Jimmy Carter. The Democrats had had almost a 50-year monopoly on the Senate that finally broke after the recessions that Volcker orchestrated. And so my concern is that Washington, they're dumb, but they're not that dumb, right? They can see exactly what happened, and they're going to do everything they can to not let another Volcker get in there and fix it next time.
So they're probably not going to be raising interest rates. So you're expecting them to lower interest rates, which obviously puts a lot more money into the economy. Would that sort of relieve unemployment, or would there be other incentives to reduce employment? Like what would happen then if they did ease rates again?
Yeah, if they lowered rates, it would help jobs. Now, there is a lag on that as well, right? So all of these mechanisms take months or even years to play through the economy. But yeah, if they lower rates, that would help jobs. Now, of course, there's many other factors that influence jobs, right? And so, you know, for example, one of the metaphors I like, if you take one random New Yorker and throw them into the river every day, will this reduce the population of New York? Well, you don't actually know, okay? Because there's so many factors that influence the population of New York that minus 365 per day, you don't know if it'll reduce the total population of New York. You do know that the act of abducting New Yorkers and throwing them in the river reduces the population, but you don't know what that turns out in the aggregate numbers, right? So, so yes, lowering rates would help jobs with a lag. But then the question for the total job number would be, what else is happening in there? And there, I think the concern is that, you know, we have this continuation of government spending, sort of hogging up resources. So, for example, if they spend $1 trillion on, you know, crony green factories or semiconductors, that is going to soak up resources, right? It's going to soak up construction workers, steel, locations, offices. Okay, it's going to soak up things that could have been used by the private sector to actually produce things that were valuable. And instead, all those resources are hogged up by people waving government subsidy checks. And then, you know, perhaps they're going to build a bunch of cylinders that will go bust and end up costing money. So if that's what, you know, what's happening at the same time as interest rate cuts, then you can actually have a continuation or worsening of the jobs picture, even though the Fed at that point would be making money cheap and easy again, trying to spark a sort of tissue fire in the economy.
If we do get something like that, where we're going to have like some sort of second stagflation, like, how do you prepare for something like that? Like, you're telling us that there's going to be something happening. And, but like, for the average person, like, you know, it's all sort of like beyond them. They're not really able to influence things. I mean, they can vote maybe every couple of years, but that's not really going to change things, especially with the Uniparty. What are some things that we can do to prepare for these eventualities?
For sure. So first, you've always been aware that anything can happen,
Okay, so, you know, we could have a double dip that's as bad as the 70s. It could be worse than the 70s. It may not happen at all, right? There's always the possibility that we've already cleared out so much deadwood during the COVID era that we may have a soft landing. Anything is possible. So, you know, if you're protecting yourself, protecting your investments and your livelihood, you do want, I think, to be prepared for any outcome. If there's not going to be a crisis, then, you know, I think more or less stay put, you know, be relatively conservative in your investments. I don't think it's a great time to go out and sort of collect dimes in front of steamrollers. I think that we've got a lot of sort of big moving parts in the economy that, you know, we're not quite sure if they're load bearing at this point. But if you are trying to hedge against a repeat of the 70s or another stagflationary crisis, then fortunately, it's very easy because we can just look back at the 1970s and see what did what. So, you know, houses kept up. Houses generally do keep up with inflation. 2008 was unique because the problem was coming from the housing sector. But generally, houses are pretty solid investments. Assuming that you are using subsidized Federal Reserve money by, you know, just doing a down payment, then it's essentially free money. And then, of course, the other one is gold and silver in the 70s just absolutely skyrocketed. So I think silver was up eightfold. Gold was up closer to 15-fold. We can only imagine what happens to Bitcoin if you get a second stagflation here. We already know what it did on the first stagflation. That was pretty exciting. So, you know, any of those assets, according to your risk appetite, are going to do you well. And then, you know, of course, the other side of it is your earnings. So, you know, as always, the advice would be, the most important things under your control are right here at home. They're your skills, your network, how good you are at your job, a new business or new skills if you see an opportunity there. And of course, your family. They're going to be the ones who, you know, the worse things get, the more important it is, or the more important become the people who are close to you. So your family, your friends, your neighbors, your network. So, I mean, really, we should all be investing in all of that anyway. But if we're looking at a storm coming from the economy itself, then absolutely you want to put as much as possible into that.
And how do you think it impacts the rest of the world? Because in a sense, it's relatively soft for the people in Western economies. But, you know, like what happens to somewhere like Japan, which has been like just zero growth for 30 years or something like that? Like what happens to people in Turkey? You know, they're going through some level of hyperinflation. What happens to all those people?
Yeah, it's much harder for those people. And, you know, I think within the Bitcoin community, because most people, or anyway, most of us who talk are living in first world countries, I think that a lot of people forget how hard these things are in poorer countries. I think that's one reason why Saifedean has done such a service, is sort of bringing some of that perspective. And he, of course, originally came to Bitcoin. You know, he was motivated less by the Federal Reserve per se and more by hyperinflations in poorer countries. So, yeah, I think this is going to be really difficult for those outside of the U.S. and particularly those in poorer countries. The IMF, and I'm not a huge fan of the IMF, but they do have economists who sit down and try to project these things out. And they're looking at essentially stagflation all over the world. As inconvenient as that is for Americans, where, you know, millennials have to live with roommates and eat ramen or maybe live with their parents, it is much, much harder in a lot of these poorer countries where they don't really have control over their destinies. In many ways, if the Fed screws something up, then they got to eat it. And, you know, Japan specifically, I think, is kind of in a different situation where in many ways we are going down the path that Japan has been running for about 30 years now, where Japan has, you know, they've been growing the government, they've been pushing out cheap money, they've essentially built themselves a zombie economy for going on 30 years. And I think my biggest concern, aside from, you know, the possibility of a repeat in stagflation, is that when we do get the recession, I think that we are absolutely going to implement the Japanese menu of policies, meaning, you know, an extreme jump in government spending. Typically in a recession or in the past couple of recessions, government deficits have gone up. If we project that to the current picture, we'd probably be looking at about another $2 trillion in deficit if we go back for the past, you know, 25 years of recessions, if we are heading towards $4 trillion deficits, not only does that start to bring in the prospect of some kind of sovereign crisis, it also means that the government is going to be absolutely hogging up the productive resources, as essentially starving entrepreneurs or starving businesses of the resources that they would need to actually get us out of the crisis. That's exactly what's been happening in Japan. They've been handing out crony money to big businesses, not the small businesses, but the big ones, while government has been spending these obscene amounts of money. My fear is that we could be looking at, you know, if you sort of combine that with the inflation, that would be effectively decades worth of stagflation here in the U.S.
Oh, decades. Wow, the plural there is pretty scary.
Well, for sure. I mean, you know, there's a lot of what ifs there. But if you look at the people who are running the country, we have had worse. FDR was worse. Mm. Nixon was worse. But we don't have the A team on. Yeah.
Wow. So for people in those countries, I think, you know, the recommendation that you gave with respect to Bitcoin, I think still applies to them. But if you do get like this giant bureaucratic state where those are the only people hiring, like, do you just go and work for those, or like, do you try to move? What's your advice for the people in developing countries where they're going to suffer much worse than the fate that we have here?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think building your own business is probably the most important. It's very difficult in a lot of these countries because it's hard to get a hold of capital. But, you know, in the internet age, there are businesses that you can run with relatively little capital if you're in a country like the Philippines. So I think that that becomes really important for people. It is, as you say, you know, it's a concern that as government takes over more and more of the economy, it also, it sort of ties its destinies with larger and larger shares of the population. So if we take Argentina with Javier Milei, roughly 30% of the population in Argentina works for the government. So I am guessing that they didn't vote for Javier Milei, right? So so it's not that he's got to win 51% of 100% of the people. He's got to win 51% of 70% of the people, right? If it goes to 45, it goes to 50, it goes to 55. I mean, at some point, it's like almost mathematically impossible to win an election on a platform of actually reducing the government. We are very, very close to that, I think, across the West. But even in many third world countries where you would expect that the government would be, you know, maybe a lot smaller just from resource constraints, but as a percent of the population, particularly as a percent of the educated population, in a lot of African countries, for example, they can employ a majority of the educated population. The educated populations are the ones who are generally sort of forming the narratives and sort of rallying people, you know, translating what's happening in the economy. They're sort of the instruments of freedom of speech. And so I think that is a huge problem, that you can get into this sort of socialist trap where socialism grows to the point where too much of the population is interested in that socialism continuing, and then it becomes very, very difficult to get your way out of it. I think the only real way out at that point is at that 1970s situation. So you got to have some kind of crisis that is big enough and rapid enough that, you know, a large share of the population wakes up, and even if they have a government job, or even if they're, you know, tied in with a union or in an industry that's getting that's existing on government subsidies, even when all that is happening, you know, they see what's happening to their kids and their community, and they react against it.
Mm. Well, I do wonder though, because once inflation gets bad enough, even those government jobs, like they're not giving you raises quick enough to make it worth.
That's a great point. Yeah. Yeah, and you see this in Venezuela, for example, where you know, even government workers get upset, and a smart government, you know, will pay its soldiers first. The Praetorian Guard has to get paid, but you know, eventually the economy gets bad enough that it can't even manage that. And historically, there have been many, many cases of that where governments have let inflation get away from them. They've been unable to pay the soldiers, and then that's pretty much the end for them. So, right, I think that there is that caveat to it.
Well, it sounds pretty negative, but as you said before, it doesn't last forever. So how do we emerge out of stagflation eventually?
Yeah, I think in a way, it's encouraging that it's getting bad so fast. I think the socialists have been on the march for decades. And I think COVID, they saw an opportunity and they essentially launched too soon. Okay, they weren't ready. They needed another decade to really kind of stamp out, brainwash, finish off the remnants. And I think they launched too early. And in a way, as horrible as it was during COVID, the totalitarian restrictions that were put on us, of course, the mass deaths that I think are going to result from some of the treatments that were promoted, as horrible as that was, there is a huge opportunity if they did, in fact, launch early. And, you know, if you look at what's happening to public trust in these institutions, if you look at just political preferences that, you know, you've got even left-wing polls that are showing that a majority of Americans support Trump. Even after just ruthless, nonstop brainwashing by really all the institutions in America, like the American Librarian Association, just organizations that never were sort of weaponized for political means. So the fact that there is so much dissatisfaction, I think it's a massive opportunity. It means that, you know, we're sort of in a spot where there are two outcomes, right? One is that it's a false alarm. It's not so bad. They'll just kind of continue, you know, regular stealing like they've always done. Okay, we can survive that. You know, we'll continue growing. We'll continue organizing. I think the other possibility is that things do get a lot worse, a lot faster. We pursue that 1970s pattern. If we do, when I look around and see all of the people who doubt the official narratives even today, I'm very encouraged. And I think in a way, you almost root for that because that's how you get a more dramatic change, right? So in other words, you don't get a Mitt Romney, you get a, you know, Donald Trump. You get sort of these more extreme figures. And if we're saying extreme figures that are catering to what the American people want, I think, you know, once people sort of step out of the matrix, people's political preferences are much, much closer to ours, being, you know, Austrian economists or libertarians or believers in freedom. What the people actually want is much closer to us. So in a sense, I'm rooting for that disruption to kind of shake things up. And then at that point, if you get some sort of a demagogue who's a populist, who's appealing to the people, then I think that they, like Javier Milei, are going to be, you know, essentially promoting ideas that we would be very happy with, ideas that promote human freedom, that take back a lot of these rights, give them back to the people, you know, things like parents having control over their kids' education, just kind of these very important leverage points that have allowed the socialists to win. I think that we have the chance to capture those back if things get bad enough. If things don't get bad enough, then I think the most likely is we just kind of continue meandering along with things getting gradually worse and worse.
So it needs to get bad to clear out some of the socialist structures, essentially, that have already built up over time.
In a sense, which, you know, the logic of it is the same as the socialists, right? This is what the socialists are always rooting for. They know that at any given moment, you have an Overton window of sort of acceptable political views, right? So, for example, if you take 100 random Americans and you ask them, what do you think about abolishing the Federal Reserve, right? Most of them are going to tell you you're absolutely crazy. They don't have strong opinions about it, okay? But they just kind of have these default points of view. And when you get a disruption, then I think at that point, there's a whole lot of people who, you know, normally they're kind of closed-minded about a new topics, but when you've got a crisis, they sort of stop and think and look around and they start to question things. And when that moment comes, which the socialists are always pining for, but I think honestly, if that moment comes, it will benefit us a lot more because, you know, when you do see what Americans actually want, when you see what people all over the world have wanted for hundreds of years, they do not want a commissar to come in and run your life. They want liberty. They want the ability to earn, to hold on to what they've earned. You know, they want to have control over their family, over their lives, over their communities.
Well, I get all that. And I'm hopeful for that future, too, where it gets so bad that people do rise up and sort of rebel against sort of this socialist order. Right. But what if the opposite happens and the socialist sort of group starts imposing harsher sanctions and create more disruption and just gets more totalitarian to keep their power. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems like a path that's definitely possible with things getting worse.
I think for sure it is. And we have a natural experiment in cities like San Francisco. And so that's kind of a microcosm where, you know, the policies there have just been atrocious. You know, you can't walk down the street. It's very, very hard to run a business in a place like San Francisco. And the voters just keep coming back for more. They're not connecting the dots. They're not upset enough. So, you know, I think the most likely outcome is that it is going to get a lot worse before it gets better. You know, all of us in some sense are going to be in a San Francisco to the extent that that's coming from the federal level. So, yeah, I think that's absolutely possible. And, you know, if people like never wake up and just let it get worse and worse, then, you know, we've also seen that in some cities. So you've got a city like Detroit or Baltimore, for example, where people fled. So, yes, it got basically unlivable. And then at that point, anybody who could escape it financially, no matter what race they were, they did escape it financially. You know, they either went out to the suburbs or they completely left. That can happen at a city level. It doesn't it's much less of an effect at a national level just because you've got nowhere to go. So in a sense, you know, the vast majority of Americans do not consider moving to El Salvador or somewhere like that. We're probably a ways from that. And so, you know, they're sort of backed in the corner in a way. So we have seen that kind of just ongoing collapse into oblivion in cities. I don't think we see it. I don't think we will see it at a national level.
No, I mean, I wish I could be more optimistic, but you know, just the election stuff and a lot of the, you know, authoritarianism that we're seeing from the federal level. I mean, seems like there's a possibility.
I think without a doubt, it's going to get worse before it gets better. And maybe for quite some time, many years. And, you know, the sort of, I think, I had a video out on this a couple of weeks ago, but talking about election fraud specifically, that if whether it's formal fraud like vote switching or whether it's sort of putting their finger on the scale through all of these captured institutions like media, one way or the other, the sort of socialists have a massive, massive advantage in elections. And, you know, when you look back historically, what's interesting about that, you know, we've got many countries where the government did cheat on elections and eventually they lose, right? You got a country like Mexico, India, for that matter. You've got a lot of countries. I mean, it's sort of a permanent temptation for governments to influence elections. And the general pattern is that, you know, of course, the reason that you cheat on elections is so that you can ignore the other side's voters, right? But the interesting effect that happens is that once you start cheating, you can also ignore your own voters, right? So every political party is kind of this permanent civil war between the special interests involved with the party, so the activists, the politicians, the lobbyists, and so on, versus their base, right? And the activists never like the base, okay? Whether it's the Republican or the Democrat Party, they're always complaining about those activists because they want different things. The problem is that once the party starts cheating on elections, on day one, it says, this is fantastic. It may as well, you know, Republican voters may as well not exist. But on day two, they say, well, it's even better because Democrat voters also don't exist. Right? And so the pattern, you know, you get this gradual like insanity in the party where their policies are increasingly divorced from what anybody in society wants, even their own voters. And then you see crazy things like having a completely open border, or you know, there's a lot of crazy stuff that we've seen, say, to do with gender, where, you know, you look at these things and like, if you're rooting for the Democrats, for example, you'd be like, what are you doing? Like, stop being so insane, just be normal. But that's a consequence of having those built-in benefits in elections, again, whether it's concrete or whether it's indirect via media or Zuckbucks or whatever. So I do think that, you know, that's probably the process we're in here. Now, it does mean that the parties get crazier and crazier. So I think we ain't seen nothing yet that we're going to have, you know, 5 years from now, we're going to say, remember back in 2023, we thought it was pretty weird back then. I think it is absolutely going to get crazier. But at the same time, that is what makes more and more people realize that the water is boiling. Then eventually you do get a quorum.
there was a city just today, I can't remember what it was, but they elected their, it's like a long-standing Democrat city, mm-hmm. pretty major city, that just elected a Republican because people are just getting fed up with it. And they're saying, yeah, mm-hmm. I know Republicans are plutocrat mm-hmm. racists or, you know, whatever the media spins about mm-hmm. them, but I'm, you know, the current guys can't shoot straight. I'm afraid to, you know, go to the local park. I got potholes. I got trash mm-hmm. piled up, whatever these sort of nuts and bolts, things that are close to them start to matter more.
Hmm. Well, and it may need to get there before some of this stuff turns around, I guess. All right. So we've talked about a lot of this stuff. You know, what would make the outcome least bad, I guess? Because, I mean, you can get pretty bad before it turns around and makes it, you know, things get okay again. You know, you could get there through a path of, you know, some economic stagnation for 5-10 years. You know, that's probably like right. a pretty good outcome. You could also get genocide and, you know, 100 million people dying as a result of really bad policies or war or nuclear or otherwise. What's the path towards the least bad outcome out of all of these really terrible choices?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, all of those are possible. They've all happened historically. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the reason why I'm sort of rooting for the banks to fail. not because I hate depositors, but because I think that is mm-hmm. one of the least painful ways to get the frogs to wake up, to get people to actually see what's happening. Plus, you know, when it happens early in the process, you can still take care of the widows and orphans. You know, bigwigs on Wall Street will get wrecked. But, you know, the actual small accounts, for example, that are still be enough resources to take care of them. So yeah, I think some sort of financial crash is probably, in the grand scheme, compared to all of the other, you know, possible sort of Ragnarok scenarios, I think that financial is probably the least harmful in terms of us being able to take care of the true victims, while the vast majority of the victims, I mean, certainly in dollar terms, are, they're people who maybe should have known better.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, it's been an interesting conversation, and hopefully we get, I guess, a relatively soft landing. I'm not even sure if that's the right phrase there, you know, it does seem like we're in a world of hurt. We're in for a world of hurt. Let's just hope to minimize it by having something like a financial crash instead of a nuclear war or something like that. So.
Yeah. And, you know, throughout, I think the important part is, you know, sometimes people get discouraged, I think, on our side, just because we seem to be losing every day. You know, every day there's some new institution that sells out or that does something stupid. But I think it's really important just for people to remember that, you know, human nature is on our side. Okay. We are seeing a lot of people break out of this. You know, whether Trump won or lost in 2020, the point is that roughly half of Americans did agree with him. Okay, so like, don't lose hope. There are tens of millions of people who agree with you. There are many more who are coming to our side. Every crazy thing they do brings more over. I think it's very important that we have optimism, that we understand that, you know, as bad as it is, it is going to be great on the other side. The key being that there are many of us, our arguments win whenever there's a fair fight. I mean, every single time censorship is removed, our side takes over the conversation because our arguments are actually correct. So, I have enormous optimism. I'm not looking forward to the challenges that are coming in the next couple of years. But on the other side of that, I'm very, very optimistic.
All right. Well, that's, I think, a very positive note to leave on. But do you have anything that you wanted to promote, anything that you're working on that you want my audience to know?
Let's see. I put up daily videos on economics and freedom. They're over on X, formerly known as Twitter. So profsainange.com. And I also do a weekly podcast roundup and articles about economics and freedom as well. Those are over at petersainange.com.
All right. Well, thank you, Peter. And hopefully we get to see more of these amazing videos as we go towards some of this stuff. All right.
All right, Jimmy. It was great chatting.
All right. Let's see. How do I stop the recording? There. Unchained Capital is a sponsor of this podcast. I'm an advisor to the company. I know the team well, and I'm excited for what they are building. If you need multi-sig, collaborative custody, or a Bitcoin-native financial services partner, learn more at unchained.com.